First of all, I want to thank everybody who got up this morning to practice the Great Way. Thank you so much. You know, we are in a very difficult situation. The whole world is in a difficult situation. We are not supposed to be in a room with more than a couple people. And we are, many of us at home, and those who are not at home, such as the people who are delivering the mail and working, stocking the grocery shelves, are making an incredible sacrifice for all of us. Just yesterday, I was working and I took a break and I went outside of my house and the mailman brought the mail and I actually told him how much I respected his courage and his commitment, and I really thanked him. And he actually he accepted my thanks. I think he had a sense of dedication. He had a sense of mission in what he was doing, and he wasn't all dismissive. I think he believes in delivering the mail, and that is the most wonderful thing in the world. It really almost brought tears to my eyes. And I mean, I've known him for a number of years, but that takes real guts, right? Any package he delivers could be an infection source, and yet there he is delivering the mail. And I went to the Stop and Shop, and I know the Stop and Shop in Piscataway, and I know one of the women who works behind the counter, and she was checking out my groceries, and she had big rubber gloves, and I was really just so deeply moved. You know, this is somebody who is making a sacrifice for all of us. So, you know, this is a very difficult time, and nobody wants to get sick. We're all in a self-quarantine. You know, because something like Zen practice is so collective, so much about doing this together, we are facing a challenge, right? So we could all get together, but it would be terrible if somebody got ill. And so this is a more prudent way to go. And also it forces us to be resourceful, forces us to renew our commitment to practicing. And everybody here who's listening right now got up this morning, and some of you I know were here right at 7 o'clock. And I don't know if you recited the sutras with me. I hope you did, because it would cover up for some of my mistakes. I think I need a bigger print on the sutra. My sutra book has to have a bigger print these days. You know, even though we're apart geographically, this heart-mind connection, is priceless. You know, you don't meet that many people in the world who understand what this is all about, you know. There are people who this resonates deeply with, people like yourselves and like me, you know. When I was in college, I read a book by Alan Watts, and many Buddhist scholars make fun of Alan Watts, but he was this very popular writer on Buddhism and Zen in the 50s and 60s. And I remember going to a bookstore and seeing this book with this beautiful calligraphy. Little did I know that the calligraphy was meant sheen, heart. And it was the Way of Zen. And it was beautiful, beautiful calligraphy on this very spare page. And I took it home and I read it, and I realized, you know, as I was reading it, I kept underlining things and thinking. At the end of the book, I thought, you know, this is it. This is my path. You know, I have never, I mean, everybody has self-doubt, but I have never had doubts about this path. You know, I have always known on some deep heart level, that this is what I should be doing with my time and with my life. And when you meet people who are like that, you know, when you meet people who have similar motivations, it's so precious. I'm so glad that we're not allowing this terrible event and the distance and the inconvenience to keep us apart. You know, we're practicing sitting together in the heart mind, Sheen. That's priceless, and following the great way together. So, you know, many people are making sacrifices, and they're getting our groceries to us, and they're delivering our mail. Doctors, my sister is an oncology nurse practitioner, and I know that she told me she's been, you know, they're all working very, very hard. Preparing, where she lives in Southern Virginia, they don't quite have the onslaught that we're starting to face here, but they're ready and they're preparing. And she said, she doesn't know anybody in her ward who has gotten ill yet, but you know, she's expecting that to happen, and it could be my beloved sister. You know, all those people are making a sacrifice, and we could say, well, what does sitting have to do with it? But I think this is really crucially important. You know, we're investigating reality. We're liberating that boundless compassion that all of us have in this way. And, you know, it makes a difference. You know, my sister reads Tricycle magazine. She's not a practicing Buddhist, but she reads and gets a lot out of this. She likes Pema Chodron, and I think Pema Chodron inspires my sister, who has a very difficult job. Imagine working with, you know, many people who are not going to make it. You know, my sister really works she said she has seen so many people die. I think Pema Chodron inspires my sister, and there are lots of people like my sister. And I've myself feel when I get discouraged or I get exhausted, I sit down on the cushion and this energy just comes, it's like saying yes to life, just comes right back. Yes to life, yes to life. So thank you for saying yes to life. Thank you for renewing your practice. Thank you for honoring the Buddha nature in yourself. Thank you for keeping our wonderful, wonderful community alive. So now, today's Teisho is on case 29 in the Mumonkan. It's called The Sixth Ancestors, Your Mind Moves. This is about Wei Neng. Wei Neng was, according to legend, Wei Neng was the son of a bureaucrat who died and left his wife and child penniless. And so, you know, Wei Neng had to did not have the opportunity to learn, three or 4,000 characters and pursue the life of an educated gentleman. Instead, he had to work very hard, and his mother had to work very hard just to support themselves. And so, according to legend, Wei Neng never learned how to read. But one day he was carrying wood. He was a woodcutter. He would bring wood into town and sell the wood. He was bringing in a load of wood, and he heard a monk reciting lines from the Diamond Sutra. And it's like, I'm no Wei Neng, but it was the same experience that I had, I think, when I was reading Alan Watts. You know, he heard these lines from the Diamond Sutra, and he thought, wow, that is it. You know, that I must go to that place. I must do this. You know? And so, you know, he couldn't leave home because his mother was absolutely dependent on him. But when she died, he left. He had no life to speak of anyway, so he went to this monastery. When he presented himself, he had no credentials. He wasn't ordained. The monk who met him, who was in charge of, you could say, sort of administrative person who gave people their room assignments and so on, and hired workers and so on. We looked at him and sized him up and said, well, look, you know, we could use a hand in the kitchen. You're not monk material, you know, but you could definitely help out in the kitchen. And so Wei Neng's job was to thresh rice. You know, even though we at our sesshins, we eat brown rice. At one time, brown rice was considered unappetizing. And even brown rice has been somewhat threshed. You know, there's a covering even on brown rice. It has to be taken off. And so there's something like a mill. You know, often it has a treadle. So you tread on the petals, and it threshes the rice. You know, that maybe Wei Neng was doing something like that. But his job was to thresh rice all day. So it's sort of a mindless task. You get on this device, and you pedal like a bicycle, and it threshes the rice, and you separate the rice from the chaff, and so on. That was his day. And then according to legend, the fifth ancestor knew he was going to die. You know, we recite that sutra in the afternoon. When the time comes for us to die, may we, you know, become aware within 7 days before our bodies drop, and may we take the news with ease. That's a Pure Land sutra that we recite. You know, basically the fifth ancestor knew his time was running out, and he had to decide who was going to be his successor. And according to the legend, there was a very articulate, educated monk named Xian Xue, and he was, everybody thought, destined to take over when the fifth ancestor died. And yet, you know, the fifth ancestor nevertheless wanted to make sure, so he decided to announce that there would be a contest. And he basically said, everybody who wants to can write a poem, and the poem should express your understanding of the Dharma, of Buddhism, of the Buddha's way. According to some versions of the story, there were a number of poems hung in this hall, in the Dharma hall, on these pillars. According to some versions of the story, there was just one. Nobody else thought he could rival Xian Xue. So there were either a number of poems or there was one poem that everybody knew was going to be the winner's poem. And that was basically Xian Xue's poem, was something like this. You know, the mind is a mirror, and it's on a stand, and you have to keep the dust off. You know, basically Zen practice is about dusting off the mirror of mind. The mind is basically like a mirror, but it gets dusty, and you have to dust it off, and that's Zen practice. Meanwhile, in the kitchen, the illiterate woodcutter, Wei Neng, heard about this. And he said to one of the cooks, listen, I'm illiterate, but I wonder if you would write my poem that I could enter into the contest. And the monks laughed, you know, your poem? Yeah, sure, man, whatever, you know. And they wrote his poem, and his poem basically said, you know, there is no mirror, and there is no dust. You know, from the beginning, not a thing is. You know, from the beginning, nothing. Ooh, ooh. So, you know, basically, both of these are true, right? Both of these are true descriptions of deep Zen practice. You know, Xian Xue was a truly awakened person, and he was talking about what you could call the relative aspect of practice. And so he was describing like the daily life of Zen practitioners. You know, if you're a woman or a man of Zen, you do your zazen. And if you've had a stressful week, You sit down on the cushion and your nerves are jangled and you're maybe a little bit upset, and three sessions later, three periods of meditation later, your mind is serene, you're grounded, your horizon is broad, you feel like you can handle anything. So there's definitely a truth to what Xianxue said. We do have to clean the dust off the mirror of the mind. But there's a deeper understanding of the mind, which we all know, because when we sit down on the cushion, what we're ultimately doing is going into deep wuxin, deep wuxin. And when you're in really deep wuxin, there is no, there is no job, there is no boss, there are no bills to pay, right? Everything is absolutely empty. And that's what liberates us from all of those problems we bring to the cushion. It's that experience of emptiness, right? Now, emptiness isn't enlightenment, but emptiness is definitely liberating. And when you go deeply into emptiness, that is the road, we could say, the road to enlightenment. Okay. So basically, when the fifth ancestor came out to inspect the poems, there might have been a number of poems, and there might have just been two, Xianxue's and Weinang. And he looked at Xianxue, and he nodded approvingly, and he looked at Weinang's poem, and he said nothing, and he went back into his room. And then, according to the legend, Weinang was asleep, and some monks came into the room where he was sleeping. He didn't have a bed, he just slept on a bunch of bags of rice. And he used old rice sacks for his blankets. And the monks came to see him and said, "Listen, for some strange reason, the abbot, the fifth ancestor, wants to talk to you." And according to the legend, Weinang went in to see the fifth ancestor, and the fifth ancestor said, "You have the deepest understanding of the great way of anybody in this temple." And he said, "But people are people, and they will never accept you as their teacher. Because some of these people have been sitting in this temple for 20 years, and Xianxue has been sitting in this temple for 20 years, and he's done all of these good deeds in the temple, and he's been Johnny on the spot on every occasion. And most people think he deserves it. And he's a deeply accomplished person. But you have the deepest insight of anybody here, even though you can't even read." And he said, "If I try to make you the abbot, there'll be like a civil war, right? And the whole temple will fall apart." So he said, "Basically, what I want you to do is just here is the robe that I received from my teacher, and he received it from his teacher. This is the robe Bodhidharma brought with him. And here is the bowl, the begging bowl, okay, that has been passed down from teacher to student. Here's the robe, here's the bowl. Those are the insignia that I am making you my Dharma heir. Now I want you to go and teach somewhere else." So Weinang leaves, and basically he goes away. He has various adventures, right? One of the other monks tries to pursue him. In another koan, there's a monk who thinks that Weinang has stolen the bowl and the robe and comes after him. It's not in the koans, but according to the Platform Sutra, Weinang lived with some hunters for a while, and he was a vegetarian, of course. So when the hunters would make a stew, he would fish the meat out and put it back in the pot and just eat like the carrots and the potatoes. They didn't really have potatoes, but at that time, but he would have some carrots and some rice or something. And eventually, Weinang did take, he was a lay person at the time, but he did take monk's vows, and he became a very distinguished teacher. And he became the sixth and last great ancestor of Zen. So This koan involves Wei Neng later, when he's become a very respected, revered teacher. And so here's the koan. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said that the flag moved. The other said that the wind moved. They argued back and forth, but could not reach a conclusion. The sixth ancestor, Wei Neng, said, "It is not the wind that moves. It is not the flag that moves. It is your mind that moves." The two monks were awestruck. Mumon's comment, "It is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is not the mind that moves. How do you see the ancestor? If you come to understand this matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when buying iron. The ancestor could not withhold his compassion and courted disgrace." Mumon's verse, "Wind, flag, mind moving, all equally to blame. Only knowing how to open his mouth, unaware of his fault in talking." So this anecdote takes place when Wei Neng was a famous Zen teacher. And it's probably like Sesshin, and these two monks are hanging out. And you know, actually in China, when there was a Sesshin, the temple would raise a flag, believe it or not. And the flag going up above the temple meant Sesshin in process, please don't disturb us, right? And people would respect that. So there must be a sesshin in process, and Wei Neng is passing by, and these two monks are sitting on a bench, and even though it's sesshin and they're not supposed to be talking, they're talking. And of course, they're lost in a kind of idle speculation, or maybe that's not fair. You know, maybe they're really wondering, what is reality? What is reality? And so, you know, at any rate, they're arguing about, one person says, look, you know, look at that flag, it's flapping in the wind. That flag is moving all the time. And the other monk says, no, no, but don't you see that the flag is only moving because of the wind? It's a classic example of causes and conditions at work, see? And so they're debating about whether, what is the cause and what is the effect? You know, is it the flag that moves? Is it the wind that moves? What's the cause? What's the effect? There's this whole tradition in Zen and in Buddhism in general of talking about events as caused by cause and effect, or causes and conditions. And it just happens that, you know, the abbot is walking by and he hears this. And instead of letting it go, he says, look, it's not the flag, it's not the wind, it's your mind that's moving. See? And the sutra says they're awestruck. So that's the koan. Now, when I give this koan to Zen students, this is a difficult koan, actually. You know, because, beginners think it's trivial. It's two people arguing about a flag blowing in the wind. And one says it's the flag that moves, the other said it's the wind that moves, and then Wei Neng comes along and says, it's your mind. And that makes total sense to us, right? We could say, of course they're watching the flag, but it's all happening in your mind, right? And so, you know, the answer seems obvious to us, right? They're perceiving, and perception takes place in the mind. But, you know, if that were what the koan, if that were the gist of the koan, it wouldn't be a koan. In other words, koans challenge our ordinary upside down way of seeing the world. That's the function of a koan. So koans are never just didactic lessons, right? A koan never just says, here's how you should think, period, right? What koans often do is to say, here's how you should think, but then you realize, oh, they really don't want me to think this way, you know? Or you realize that there's something terrifically incoherent about the ordinary mind, the ordinary person's way of looking at the world. See? So every koan is sort of like, has like a koan is like a delicious chocolate, and inside there's a little stone, right? And if you can't find the stone, or it's like a bait, you know, if you throw bait, I do not fish because I've been a vegetarian for 40 years, but if you're a fisherman, you take a big hook and you put it inside a piece of meat and you throw it into the water. And the fish jumps up and grabs the meat and then he gets hooked. Well, there's a hook in every koan. So if you're not, and you'll get hooked if you work with the koan. But in this case, there doesn't seem to be a hook. Of course, they're looking at the flag, they're looking at the wind, and Wei Neng is saying, you know, it's flag, wind, who cares? It's really your mind. Mumon, Master Mumon, the editor of the koan collection, comes along and says, you know, forget the flag, forget the wind, forget your mind. Even the mind isn't moving. So now it's beginning to look more like a koan, right? There's a hook here somewhere. There's a stone in this candy somewhere. You won't really find it probably till you begin to sit down on the cushion and you go into deep mushin and you say moves, moves, moves. That you could interpret that as the turning word. See, every koan has a kind of kernel or core, a turning phrase or a turning word. And that's what you focus on. You should definitely read the whole koan. But in this case, it's moves. So, you know, if you work on a koan like this, you know, day one, if you're working on it at Sesshin, day one, it just seems like an amusing story and you feel like you know the answer. Of course, my mind, of course. Day two, you know, less certain. Day three, less certain. And you, as you work with the koan more, you may be more and more confused about whether your mind moves or not. See? And students who have been working on this koan for a long time, some of them come in and say, moves, my mind moves. And I say, no. Go back and sit, look again. And then they come in and say, it doesn't move. And I can say, no. Go back and look again. Now, the purpose of answering that way isn't that I'm trying to drive people crazy, and it isn't that the answer doesn't matter, whatever answer you give, it's always wrong. The reality is that it's more complicated than moves or doesn't move. See, we humans tend to think in binaries, right? It's either black or it's white. It's either right or it's wrong. Because we think in binaries, it's very hard for us to get out of some of our basic assumptions. So, you know, the koan basically says, does the mind move or doesn't it? But that's a false, that could be a false choice, see? Maybe the mind moves and maybe it doesn't move at the same time. See, now, this is that anybody who would notice this about the mind would be like a great genius, right? It would be an amazing Zen student. This is a very difficult koan because people get trapped in the binary thinking. The mind, does my mind move or not? And you know, actually, it's funny. if you sit down on the cushion and it's day three of Sesshin, and you will notice that at certain times, your mind is absolutely motionless, right? Motionless. So if you've been practicing a mu koan, wu xin, and you're going mu, 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 you know, you can reach a place, or even when you're watching your breath, you can reach a place that is absolutely motionless. The stillness is it's deafening stillness, right? Deafening, thunderous stillness. There's absolute stasis, immovable, unchangeable, see? And that's, anybody who's done mu for a while has had a taste of that immobility, that immobility. See? And it's imperturbable. When you get into that place, you know, last week, the stock market lost 30% of its value in like 2 days. And, you know, like many people who work, you know, Rutgers professors don't have a pension. The state of New Jersey doesn't pay us a pension. All of our money is in a portfolio, right? That's our retirement, basically. The state got off in a way easy by just saying, well, you can have a nice portfolio and we won't have to pay you a pension. And so, you know, everybody I know in my job, you know, was sort of like holding his or her breath because, you know, your life savings is going off a cliff. And when something like this happens, you know, it's terrifying, or can be terrifying. And, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep mushin, and if you sit long enough or you've done enough sitting, you know, you realize it doesn't matter. There's a certain sense it doesn't matter if you have $1 million or no dollars, right? At some point, there's a way in which it doesn't matter. You can say, well, it matters if you need those dollars to live, but you know, actually, if you're in deep mushin, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter. There's a way of finding that imperturbability. You know, when the Buddha was alive, his entire family, the Shakya, his entire country was wiped out in a genocide. You know, must have taken a lot of zazen, but, you know, he was able to get to a place of stillness and serenity. See? Some of the Buddha's own disciples, you might not know this, but the arhats, some of the Buddha's arhats were murdered. They were like murdered by rival organizations, you know. There was competition, value competition, and the great Zen masters have been murdered. Great Zen masters have died in plagues, you know. People have lived through much worse than what we're living through, and managed to be serene, managed to look at it as though it, you know, these are merely causes and conditions. The stock market goes up and the stock market goes down. That's what a stock market does. People make millions of dollars and they lose their shirts, you know. My grandfather went through the Great Depression in Newark, New Jersey. You know, he was an engineer. He was repairing cars to make lunch money, basically, right? So, you know, it's not as bad. I have it better than my grandfather. But even if I don't have it better than my grandfather, there's a place to go which is imperturbable. So help me. And it's mushin. And when you're in mushin, if you sit long enough, you reach a place where you realize, in this stillness, everything is already perfect. Everything is already perfect. You know, I've had a number of my had a number of people in my family die. My brother died many years ago of cancer. My father died many years ago, also cancer. My mother also died of cancer. You know, I was with them. I wasn't with my brother, but I was with my father and my mother when they died. I was right there at their side. You know, I had to do a lot of sitting. And, you know, of course, you love your parents, you love your brother, you hate to see them die, it hurts. You sit down on the cushion and you get into this imperturbable place. See. Then, you know, that's part of the mind. But then, you know, you also notice when you're sitting on the cushion and you go into Mushin, that you come out of Mushin and you hear birds, maybe geese, you know, wild geese flying over the Zendo when we're doing Sesshin. You hear that, and instead of saying, oh, there are geese, you become one with the cries of the geese. It's just like you disappear and you become one. You merge with the object of your attention. And the geese are moving like lightning over the Zendo. And if you're in empty mind and you look, you'll notice that every moment is flowing like a stream. You know, every moment is changing, moment to moment to moment. It's just like this never-ending procession of moments, each bringing something new. Now, you know, if you're working with this koan, you could say, well, which is it? You know, is it the stillness of absolute emptiness, or is it the raging river of moment-by-moment events, right? Is it that emptiness that I experience, that motionlessness, that imperturbability, or is it my becoming one with the geese? And actually, you don't have to choose. See, I'm giving away a little bit of the koan, but everybody experiences a koan in a different way. You know, you don't have to choose because these are both aspects of your consciousness. And it's important to get their relationship correct. Get their relationship correct. There's one more aspect of your consciousness that I want to talk about. Stan and I and Keith and I have been working on reading some of the major Zen koans. Sutras, rather. And we've read a number of sutras and also Egbert and I. And anybody who, you know, I'm thinking of actually doing like a sutra discussion group online. I'm thinking of starting some sutra discussion groups. And if you're interested, please let me know, you know, because basically people who are interested have approached me and said want to study the sutra. But if you're interested, you know, we could use, I haven't mastered Zoom yet, as you know, from what happened this morning. Alex, I think, saved the day by streaming Facebook into Zoom, but that's another story. But, you know, eventually we could use Zoom or some other platform to do sutra study. But we've been reading the Lankavatara Sutra, and the Lankavatara Sutra is a very important sutra. And in fact, Bodhidharma, Dhammo, brought this sutra with him. He only brought one book from India when he came, and it was the Lankavatara Sutra. And the Lankavatara Sutra is really the sutra for the Zen school. And there, for years and years, there was a rather difficult translation by D.T. Suzuki, but Red Pine has done this wonderful, wonderful new translation, and now it's like actually somewhat readable. It's a very difficult, it's like reading every sentence is like a little koan, right? You can see where koans came from, because the Lankavatara Sutra is trying to challenge the way we look at the world. It's trying to do what sutras, I mean, koans do. It's trying to overturn, liberate us from our upside down views, our misunderstandings of reality. And so, you know, even though Zen calls itself a tradition outside the sutras, outside the scriptures, please don't believe that for a minute. That was a Zen propaganda. Let me just say that's Zen propaganda. You know, when Zen was competing with other schools in China, it always used to say, well, you may read the sutras, but we are so great, we don't even have to read the sutras. But actually, it would be good for Zen students to read the sutras. And it would be especially good for Zen students to read the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra in translation, and the Lankavatara Sutra. And the Lankavatara Sutra is fascinating because it's early on, it gets into this question of the mind. If you read the sutra, the first part is actually hilarious. You know, in many scriptures, there are very few parts that you could call hilarious, right? But the Lankavatara Sutra actually has parts that are like, I find myself wanting to laugh out loud. There is the early section is a series of questions. And one of the early sections is a person basically asking the Buddha a series of questions, and they're totally crazy questions. It's just a total hodgepodge. You know, if the lights have gone off, so I can't read the passage to you right now, but we have timing. If you don't know, if you're just looking in for the first time, the timers go off if there's no motion. The motion sensors don't notice, and they shut the room's lights off. But the questions are crazy. Like, some of them are, what are causes and conditions? You know, what is the mind? And some of them are like, if you were a vegetarian, will you live to be 100? You know, do Buddhas have body odor? You know, stuff like that. And the questions are all sort of like that. And the answer that comes, the Buddha's answer is, you know, there's no such thing as body odor doesn't exist, living to 100 doesn't exist, and he just negates all of these things. He does just what Joshu does when a monk says, does a dog have Buddha nature? Joshu pushes the monk right into emptiness. And in this sutra too, after you get all these crazy questions, the Buddha just says, he just shows how every question is based on a total misunderstanding that there's no such thing as body odor. You know, body odor is an idea that was invented in the 1940s to sell soap in the United States, you know. So at any rate, then the sutra, after it sort of shows that emptiness is the way to wisdom or enlightenment, it starts talking about the way the mind works. And it really says that the mind has, you know, our mental lives, you could say, have three aspects. There is there's the part that is always moving. The unfolding, Red Pine translates it as the unfolding aspect. So, you know, moment by moment by moment, something is always happening. It's one damn thing after another. You know, and if you can be mindful of the moment and just notice there's this moment and this moment and this moment and this moment and this moment, and it never stops. It's like a river. It's like a river. That's the unfolding aspect. Now, there's also what it calls the part that doesn't move. It calls it the intrinsic aspect, the part that doesn't move. So both of those are aspects of your consciousness. There's the part of your mind that is mushin, that is motionless and imperturbable, and there's this other part of your awareness, which is always changing. That's the unfolding. So there's the intrinsic and there's the unfolding. And there's a third aspect, which it calls the karmic. You could call the karmic aspect. See, and karma is created by our mental habits, right? Or is our mental habits, the sum total of our mental habits. So look, if you grew up in poverty, And your parents would fight about money, and your mother would sit at the dining room table and cry and say, "How am I going to pay these bills?" Right? That happens to many people. When something like the stock market crash happens, you welcome the event with terror, right? It's terrifying. Because you remember being a child and seeing your mother crying at the dining room table because she doesn't have enough money to pay her bills. Where are we going to get money for the kids to have shoes on their feet, right? And as a kid, you want to help your mother and you're afraid. Your parents are afraid, so it must be really frightening. So maybe all your life you watch those pennies. You make sure you're always watching the pennies, and maybe you've really sacrificed a lot. Instead of going on vacations, you've put that money in your 401k, you've put it bought stocks, and you've done everything they told you to do, right? And then, the stock market just jumps off a cliff. That's your karma. When that event happens, it's just like, oh my God, it's the end of the world. Now look, it's not actually the end of the world. Marpa, the Tibetan master Marpa, was told by his teacher Tilopa to get money to get gold dust, actually, to pay for the teachings. Tilopa said, "I won't teach you unless you give me 3 bags of gold dust, basically." And Marpa worked his ass off and brought 3 bags of gold dust. And then, Tilopa took the gold dust bags and emptied them out in the wind and said, "What do I care about gold dust?" In other words, how you look at an event like the stock market crash or like, the coronavirus is colored by your karma. So some people responding to an event like this just want to, protect themselves. And maybe when you were a little kid, your parents didn't take care of you. They didn't, they when you were getting beaten up on the playground, they didn't reassure you. And you grew up fearful. You grew up feeling no one was sticking up for you, so you had to protect yourself, right? Maybe when coronavirus happens, you think, nobody's gonna protect me. I'm gonna have to take care of this coronavirus myself. I've got to stay, it's every man for himself, basically, see. And that's your karma. And there's other people. I remember reading an article about a guy in Wuhan, during the height of the infection there. And when people were dying, doctors were dying, he was a single man, and he said, "I'm going to drive people to the hospital. I know I could get an infection." He was interviewed, actually, he was also interviewed by the BBC. And he said, "I'm going to drive people to the hospital because the ambulances are not working, and I'm just going to do it." And he had enough, money wasn't an issue for him. And I don't know if he got infected or not, but he was interviewed by the BBC. I read this article in online, the BBC transcript. And he basically was putting his life on the line every day to help people. Now that's karma too, right? That's the karmic aspect. One person responds to events by closing all the doors and closing the windows, and we should protect ourselves. That's certainly true. We don't want to get infected. You don't want to get coronavirus, and I don't want anybody to die. But this other person, his particular karma said it's okay if I die because I'm doing something to help others. And both of those are ways of looking at exactly the same set of circumstances. The terror some people feel over coronavirus, or the terror they feel at the collapse of the stock market. That's karma. And this other man's response, which is rescuing people in need at his own risk, that's also karma. So there's the unfolding aspect. You know, coronavirus infection breaks out in late December in China. You know, basically the United States does nothing to get ready. It arrives here, you know, and so on and so on. That's the unfolding aspect, right? The stock market collapses. New York has a record number of infections. We surpass China. That's unfolding. The karmic aspect is what we bring to the table, you know, how we experience these events, given our own, the psychology that it, that causes and conditions have created, right, for us. But there's this third thing, right, which is the intrinsic or the unmovable. And so, you know, when you're walking around, it's not just the unfolding, it's not just the karmic, there's also this behind your eyes, so to speak, there's the immovable. And it's always there, it's always there. We don't access it, but it's always there. See? So you know, when you're walking down the street, you're looking, you know, if it's New York City, you don't want to, you know, bump into somebody and so on. You're watching your every step. You're looking at people in front of you. You're totally absorbed in the unfolding dimension, the movement, like the flag and the wind. How you respond to those events is the karmic aspect, right? The karma. But all that time, there is behind your eyes, in front of your eyes, New York, you know, Fifth Avenue. Behind your eyes, if you look at your own mind, even in the midst of a crowd, Mu is there. There's this intrinsic, unmoving thing that's always there. See, there's another koan. I think it's Dijong's always close, always close. What's always close? The intrinsic aspect, see? It's always there. It's right there. We don't notice it. And it takes a lot of zazen before people discover the intrinsic aspect, that immovable, unchanging, and we call it emptiness. If you keep sitting, its character will change. But for now, we can call it emptiness. And, you know, actually, if you want to change your karma, the way to change your karma is to go into the intrinsic. So, you know, when you change, when you find yourself responding with terror to something, that's a sign that you are not on the path, you know, you're not in an awakened state, right? And you sit down on the cushion and you get into deep mushin. And if you do that long enough and often enough, you stop responding to circumstances with this in this conditioned way. You stop having conditioned responses to events. You know, at first you feel terror when the stock market crashes, but you sit down on the cushion and you do zazen for a week, and one day you're sitting on the cushion and you laugh. You say, who cares? What good is gold dust to me, right? I'm not going to let the stock market make my life less valuable, less alive, less beautiful. Screw the stock market, you know? Don't be a slave of these idiots on Wall Street, please. They're unworthy of your admiration. You know, so when you get liberated, you realize I'm not going to go every day to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and look at the charts going down. Screw them. I'm not going to be a slave. I'm going to be a free person. I'm going to have joy no matter what happens to me. See, now that's liberation, and that comes from being able to find the intrinsic, the unmoving. The Heart Sutra says that if you go into the unmoving, it can liberate you from all karma. And that emptiness, it promises that there is no karma, that the intrinsic, the unmoving, cannot dissolve. And so, you know, our conditioned responses to things are not necessarily our doing. You know, karma is not necessarily, there's such a thing, in fact, the Lankavatara Sutra says there's such a thing as collective karma or cultural karma, as well as personal karma. You know, if you live in the United States, you know, money is really important. If you lived in Tibet a century ago, they didn't even have money, right? So, you know, the name of our game is wealth and power here in the United States, but that's a cultural thing, right? There's cultural karma. So, you know, please be aware that when you're walking around, you looking out of your eyes at the world of change, but behind your eyes, every once in a while, pause and look back at your mind. Look back at your mind. Look behind your eyes, so to speak. It's not really located behind your eyes. It's not located anywhere. There's this emptiness right there in the middle of Fifth Avenue, right there in the middle of the chaos. And when you go there, you know, it transforms your karma. So, you know, the intrinsic, the unfolding, and the karmic, these are the three sort of like ingredients that are necessary for our liberation. Or they're always there, but your awareness of those three puts you on the path to waking up. So this is a really wonderful koan because both of these things are true of the mind. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and the two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved, the other said the wind moved. They argued back and forth, but could not reach a conclusion. The sixth ancestor said, "It's not the wind that moves, it's not the flag that moves, it's your mind that moves." The two monks were awestruck because they'd never looked at their mind. They'd never turned from the unfolding and looked at the intrinsic. See, they never looked at their minds. All they looked at was the sort of form in front of their eyes, the parade of forms in front of their eyes. Mumon says, "It's not the wind, it's not that moves, it's not the flag that moves, it's not the mind that moves. How do you see the ancestor? When you look at the ancestor, are you aware of the intrinsic behind your eyes? If you come to understand this matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when buying iron. The ancestor could not withhold his compassion and courted disgrace." In other words, he was compassionate. When Mumon runs somebody down, remember, he's paying him a compliment. "Wind, flag, mind moving, all equally to blame. Only knowing how to open his mouth, unaware of his fault in talking."